okay. We don't expect you to know everything. And we normally begin by saying our names so that the recording will contain information of who we are. So this is Randall Dodd. It's about 3:45 on Friday, September 24th. We're at the Federal Reserve Board talking to Nell Lang. If I got your name correctly.
Nellie. Yes.
Nellie Lang.
Uh-huh.
Sorry. But my name again is Randall Dodd, D-O-D-D. And
Daniel Kovitz.
I think you spell your last name, Mr. Kovitz.
C-O, V as Victor, I-T-C.
And we're both in the Division of Research and Statistics.
Okay. And Lang is L-I-A-N-G.
L-I-A-N-G, yes.
David Caperton with the board, C-A-P-E-R-T-O-N.
And I'm Alexis Simmendinger, S-I-M-E-N-D-I-N-G-E-R, with the SCIC writing team.
Okay, one of the things, I had a couple of ranges of things to talk about. Would you happen to have a bio you could contribute to our record so we know
the
background?
The one off the website, is that complete? Can we use
or
that one?
Off the website?
It's got some of your publications and your education. But doesn't tell us if you've had any private sector jobs or anything like that.
Yeah, and I have not. Since I haven't looked at the one that's on the public website, I can forward one. Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
And it could well be that one when I forward it, but I have not looked at it in a while.
Yeah, it looks like pretty abbreviated, but to the point.
Okay. My bio is complete on the website.
Okay, great. One thought, range of questions, some very particular, some a little bit general about the view of the Fed and your participation in the Fed. Let's start with a few particular ones, just a sort of icebreaker. When did you or your colleagues at the Federal Reserve Board became aware of problems in the asset-backed commercial paper market?
Mm-hmm. So let me start by saying, you know, we became aware of performance issues in subprime credit late 2006, early 2000. You know, we were following this. And early 2007, by then, it had been clear that some of the lenders had started filing for bankruptcy. There were starting to be periodic concerns in some of the financial markets. Early on in 2007, we were starting to talk to dealers on Wall Street, the CP dealers. As an institution, we maintain relationships, with dealers to hear about market conditions at times. We started calling, how much subprime, do you have in your portfolios? Is this an issue for you? Are you concerned? And in February 2007, when there was this day where the stock market fell 10%, you may all remember this, we were all starting wondering if this was related to subprime. Was it really just related to China stock price decline? Everybody was just thinking about it. So we were on the phones with lots of dealers, every one of them.
Including commercial paper dealers.
Exactly. We were talking to commercial paper dealers in particular.
Is that a normal function of the research department? Or research and statistics department?
So we monitor developments in the commercial paper market. Mm-hmm. It's a source of financing for non-financial corporations.
Oh, definitely.
From the perspective of monitoring financing of non-financial corporations,
right.
So the unsecured commercial paper market, so traditionally the focus, particularly unsecured paper issued by non-financial corporations.
Right, large corporations. And we've been following it following it closely for many, many years. We publish statistics on the board's website on ratings and issuance on CP every day. So that's part of our, that comes out of the research and statistics. Yeah. That's our group. So
I've seen it.
Yeah.
Not the H15. It's H4 or something. What's the daily one?
What is the daily paper? I don't know.
I don't remember. I think
H8
you're right.
Or RAIDS. H4 could be the
H15.
One of my early jobs in grad school, I had to go down and send a line with the winos at the New York Federal Reserve Board and pick up the paper every day because there was no internet back then. Or, so that was the only way to get it was a hard copy, and
it
I'd walk it over
copy.
To the treasury floor.
It's not just on the H15 release. I think for over 10 years, we've produced a website on the commercial paper market.
Right.
It's part of an arrangement where we get data on the market, all the transactions data. That helps us understand what's going on in the market, and in exchange, we produce this daily website.
So based on daily transactions, we post, outstandings, rates, overnight, 5-day, 10-day rate, out to 270 days. So that's daily
You don't report changes in dealer inventories, do you?
No. So these are transactions. We don't know who's on what side of the transactions. These are transactions, prices, and quantities.
Did you ask the dealers about their inventory, like whether they're going to have to buy it back or whether they're selling it?
So at the time when we started discussing in February, and there was no signs of any concern in the CP market, but this was just, we should ask, our questions were about, do you have very much subprime in any of your asset-backed CP programs? Do you think? Are you vulnerable? Are there vulnerabilities?
Even more generally, I think we ask, does the asset-backed commercial paper market have a lot of subprime?
Yeah.
Is it funding a lot of subprime?
Right.
Is there a concern among investors about subprime exposure of asset-backed commercial paper?
Right.
Sorry, I thought I did. Yeah, sorry. So you're asking about subprime in their own bank portfolios and then subprime in
Not in bank portfolios. These were the dealers, the CP dealers. Could have been any investment bank, whoever the big dealers are. And it's like Lehman and Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan. And it's just their CP desks.
Right. Which
is not.
But our perspective wasn't as supervisors.
Right. From a research economist point of view, how is this market functioning? And it wasn't at all with the banks. So there was really nothing. Nothing to worry about. Their investors, nobody was calling them, and asking them about this. They just said it can't be big. And there was a big faith in the structure of these conduits. The structure, there are, at the time, you either over-collateralize, you put in equity, there's a little often some kind of support from somebody. So there's just a faith in the structure, mm-hmm. in the assets and the conduits. That there just wasn't a concern that was being registered by anybody.
I guess historically, too, most of the structures have been multi-sellers.
Exactly.
And so up until that point, they were of a different nature. And so maybe they didn't notice so much implications
of
the new structure.
I don't know when the securities arbitrage program started up, and that was sort of, mm-hmm. seems like halfway to an SIV.
Right. So traditionally the multi-seller, then there were some single-seller programs, the finance companies that just finance their own loans and receivables until they securitize. There were the mortgage single-sellers, which were kind of specialties. And then you started getting these securities-type programs, the securities arbitrages and then the SIVs.
And to give you a perspective on how we thought about that segment of the market, I think in the early part of the decade when we were producing this website, I think asset-backed CP was just part of financial CP.
Is that right?
Yeah, because mm-hmm. these were financial intermediaries.
Yep.
They were SIVs. Mm-hmm.
They were just
SPEs, I think is what we referred to. Yeah.
Special purpose entities.
So we thought of them as, they're part of financial, that other part of.
Mm-hmm. Well, they are definitely financial in nature, even if irrespective of the sponsor, I guess.
Yeah.
Because they're,
But then I think, I can't remember the year, but at some point we started breaking out asset-backed commercial paper as its own category.
Right.
And it was very difficult to do because we didn't know much about the market or even the names of the programs, and so we had to talk to the industry. Mm-hmm. And
They're exempt from
the data issues.
There's like three different exemptions they get from the Securities Act, and so once you're outside of disclosure and registration, it's hard to track these rascals down.
It's really
getting that list. I remember it wasn't easy, and there was a lot of it, you know, us looking around and then going to the dealer community and saying, the dealer and the issuer community, saying, is this consistent with what you see in the market?
Did you talk to any of the dealers about the use of portals?
Portals?
No.
Not familiar.
It's not about Dean John Malkovich. There are a lot of ways in which they're distributing commercial paper with through portals and also mutual fund investments. So customers, instead of having to have multiple accounts, could come through a single account offered by a bank. And the bank would either offer them sort of a menu-looking approach, or the bank itself would place it in some place. And so what it created was a convenient way for people to get funds into certain money investments, money market investments. But it oftentimes reduced the level of transparency. Perhaps more acute with money market mutual funds than with commercial paper.
Yeah.
But, for example, some money market mutual funds were getting those type of investments through a bank's portal. Let's say it's just Bank of America for a random name. Right? So you don't know who the ultimate investor is. So in the event of a problem, you can't contact investors and say, listen, the rumors in the market are baseless. You can't talk. Mm-hmm. There's no dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes you get blind runs because they don't even know who they're running on.
Yeah.
Right? Because, in other words, I just didn't know if that had popped up on your screen.
No, most of, I think, the dealers, no. It didn't pop up at all.
That's all right. I don't know how.
I can speculate as to why not, but I don't know why I would.
I've seen them more with money market mutual funds. I don't know how extensive this is with commercial paper.
Yeah.
But it is an interesting. Mm-hmm. It's clear why it is convenient. It's also kind of, in hindsight, clear why it's a little dangerous.
Sure.
One of the reasons it might not have come up again are the data that we have on the market is transactions data. We don't know who the investors are.
We don't have
that. Was always
One of the things I've been asking them is how you structure this market, how do the quotes come in, how do you actually execute the trade, right? How do they find you? How do you submit your kind of quotes out in the market? So that would be and that's, as far as I know, not written down anywhere. A lot of it is flow of funds kind of approach, right? There's so much stock, the stock, there's a flow, and the net is a change in the stock. And so it's that kind of flow of funds, kind of a look at most of the stuff I see, not just from your own Z1, but from, who's the gal, Marcia, that writes that great book?
Yeah, Stigham.
Stigham, thank you. And
the money market, whatever, something, yeah.
Yeah, it's been, I've been around since since I've been around. But,
it's large.
But those are some elements that I've started to look into that sort of pop up a few questions. I'm also asking these questions at the behest of some of my colleagues. I'm sometimes just a vessel here.
No, that's we understand.
Because we work together. Pardon me. Yeah. Now, also another part of the money market. This is what I should ask you next. After Bear's hedge funds declared that they were in trouble, did that change your what you did to monitor the market?
So I think we started monitoring the markets differently well before Bear Stearns. So Bear Stearns was in, say, March of 2008, and the initial...
When the firm collapsed, the hedge funds
just in the summer
in June
of
2007.
Yeah, June 2007. Oh, yeah. So I would say we started even earlier than that, like in February when we started seeing, when the subprime problems started, and it was becoming clear. You just want to see where it's going to, how it's going to transmit through the financial system. So you're just sort of on heightened alert for lots of things. In the summer of 2007, one particular asset-backed CP program, a single-seller mortgage program, extended its paper, which was an unusual feature. And I mean, 5 years ago, my guess is no one actually knew about, had this, and wouldn't have known it was actually happening. They extended paper. They basically couldn't roll, so they had the option to extend it to their investors. And shortly thereafter, the parent company was American Home Mortgage, I think, declared bankruptcy. That was July 2007. At that point, we were watching closely. That was a single seller mortgage. It would have, which is a asset-backed conduit, which, you know, just it houses mortgages until it securitizes. And it was pretty clear at that point the mortgage market, the securitization market, was starting to collapse. And it was not clear they were ever going to be able to securitize this thing and sell it. So no one wanted to be, you know, roll over the CP that held these mortgages because it wasn't clear that they're going to be able to.
But this was a silver conduit, you said. So it has
a straightforward single seller mortgage, asset backed commercial bank.
Okay.
It basically warehoused mortgages until
right.
they were securitized, and that caused some people started worrying about what was in all asset backed in some sense.
Right.
Just to clarify, you were talking to the dealers in early 2007, and you got all these assurances, reassurances, right? And then you're saying that you were on heightened alert for a lot of things. You continued to keep going through. So can you just elaborate a little bit on, just describe, you got all these reassurances, and you were skeptical, or you just...
I think you just have to stay alert to, you know, at that point, the stock prices, the bond market. I mean, so... Not necessarily about the CP market in particular. It wasn't that we didn't take their word for it. It was that this isn't, all of a sudden volatility in the markets is starting to creep up. Everybody is concerned about mortgages, so you want to watch the equity markets and the corporate bond markets and the, you know, all the ABS markets, and it's kind of our job. that's sort of in the from the research side of the Federal Reserve. We're trying to monitor financial markets, the availability of credit to the household and business sectors.
And
so that's what we do.
And I think with respect to the ABCP market, it's hard to remember exactly, but I remember talking to, you know, the analyst who was the CP analyst at the time, and, you know, he was thinking about, so, you know, thinking about what was going on in the ABCP market more than he would have in the past, and thinking about, you know, why are the spreads higher? I remember him coming up with some research ideas about, God, these spreads are just a couple basis points higher. Why are they higher? What does that embed? Does that embed, you know, systematic risk? Is, you know, what is it about these structures that is causing these spreads to be priced in a little higher?
Mm-hmm.
Not anything near what ultimately happened.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So there was some subtle changes to the market price that preceded the larger malfunctioning
very,
of the market.
Very subtle. So if you look at just kind of what CP spreads, this is a very high grade, you know, the asset-backed. The spreads were, you know, on asset-backed CP 5 or 10 basis points above like a Fed funds rate. I don't know if these were LIBOR or Fed funds. I can't remember.
They wouldn't
so
use
then
LIBOR.
They
probably better than LIBOR. They'd probably
yeah.
be closer to a cash management bill or something.
Yeah.
Would be, I would think.
The Fed funds target is often what we will look at them
until they really move.
So
it's just the difference between the spreads and the structured products and the spreads, say, on the unsecured financial paper.
No.
That there was always a little teeny bit of difference in there, but it never really came up on the radar screen until that time. I mean, of course, once spreads started to move, they moved in a really dramatic way. And we'd been following this market for 10 years, never seen anything like that.
Right.
So,
so they went up to maybe 100 basis points,
yeah.
and then but the following year, and then they were up at like 500 basis points again. Never seen
again. The unsecured market in I think was January 2001.
Mm-hmm. Following Enron or the...
Before then, it was the California Utilities.
California Utilities, yeah.
And that was nothing compared to the first week of this.
Yeah, that seemed more idiosyncratic than this.
Yeah.
So that wouldn't have been quite as...
That's right.
And so, if I can understand the nature of your surveillance activities, it's not like you got a list of the dealers, and then you got some staff that have the list and know who to call, and you kind of call them up, you know, in succession and say, you know, what's going on, how much volume you got out there, and
I think, to be fair, I don't think it was. We're just trying to understand the world.
Yeah.
I don't think we thought this was a risk in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I also just to... We're not about checking with particular dealers and how they're operating. Our perspective is, what is the credit flows? What is credit that is available to the corporate sector or to the household sector? So our interest in it is more not how somebody is functioning or something, but what are they perceiving as to be the economic risks or the big financial risks out there, and not so much how are you operating, you know, are you covering your positions?
It's more their view on the market than how they're operating.
Exactly. It's very much, you know, what are you hearing, what are your investors most worried about? It's not so much about them, but about, like, what risks are they worried about? Are we worried, like right now, are we worried about a double-dip recession, or are you worried about Europe? Those are the kinds of... that's the kinds of questions we ask, not like... how are you covering your positions, or, you know, or how are you managing your risks?
You're trying to get soundings.
Although that would be, if you would ask them their inventory, that would probably pick up subtle changes in the market, like some of the bid-ask spread data would.
It's possible.
That would be possible.
But they may not tell us that. We have no, you know, that's not the sort of thing they might tell us.
Huh.
Right? I mean, why would they, you know, we're just economists, you know, in the research division. You know, we're not like a supervisor or a regulator in that sense, you know. So, I mean, I'm not sure anyone would say, well, here's our book, and, you know, this is what happened over the last couple of weeks. So I'm not sure they'd tell us that. They might qualitatively, if we asked it that way, but it's not the way we would typically.
So these same phone calls aren't used to collect the quantitative data for the Z1 or the other?
No.
That's a different team within the board?
We just use solid data there. It's not based on conversation. It's the flow data that's, you know, like, you know, we get data feeds every night.
I see, and they just do that. That's on automatic pilot.
Yeah.
So they send it in, and you got some guy that puts it into a bigger spreadsheet. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. This is more on just to develop a little market color about what's happening. We're seeing quantities do this. We're seeing spreads, prices do this. You know, just tell us a little bit about what's behind that. And it's usually sort of a market-wide story, an economy-wide story, not something specific to a particular firm or a dealer.
Well, moving on to repo markets, when did you notice that there had been a change in the use of non-traditional assets to collateralize repo transactions?
So I don't know the answer to when we noticed. So this is repos used by usually non-bank financial intermediaries to fund. So it's in investment banks. The banks use it to some extent, but it's not as big a part of their funding structure.
Proportionally.
But again, since we're not following particular firms, this wasn't something that was especially on our radar screen. So I don't know how to, you have any, I don't know exactly how to answer that in terms of when.
Right, so you know, it's hard to know when you first notice the sky turn from blue to red. Kind of.
I think that's how I would.
What way did you change your surveillance of money markets to include more. Did you start trying to, in the way you did surveillance on commercial paper, did you add or include repo market activities and quantities?
We did not, but others did. So from our perspective, again, because it's not, repo isn't a direct source of financing for the non-financial corporations. It's the way financial companies finance themselves. So we're doing flows to the non-financial corporate sector and households. So CP is a financing source. Repo's not. Repo facilitates the markets that kind of allow that financing to happen, but we didn't focus on how financial intermediaries finance themselves.
So when you say others did, you don't mean...
I would mean the supervisors or the, yeah. You know, it could be our bank supervisors, it could be the SEC, it could be people who focus more on how do financial intermediaries function. And money funds, you know, we track that. We kind of try to follow what they're holding and that kind of thing. But and just early on in 2007, there wasn't a broad run on money funds when the asset-backed CP market was going. So just
right.
Generally,
but that was
speaking,
much later.
That was a year later. That was a run on the money funds. This was a run on the asset-backed CP programs. So.
Right. That was more because of Lehman and was it Reserve Fund broke the buck,
yeah.
And then things started
then
to
started to work
change
out.
Pretty
yeah,
quick.
Exactly. But yeah, during this episode, it was just on the asset-backed conduit structures.
We did talk to some money market funds who had a lot of pressure during the ABCP problem, and they did face not the kind of problems they faced in, let's say, late September, October of 08, but
right.
They did face problems. And
that's
they
right.
discussed the differential experiences of some of their colleagues. We talked to a range of
yeah.
money market funds, and they reiterated, I think what you have probably found out, was that those multi-sellers actually did fine,
yeah.
and that if they were able to talk to their clients, they could explain to them the distinction and that they were fine, and in fact they were able to stay in business and not suffer any substantial run because they had a relatively manageable number, I wouldn't say small, but manageable number of investors that you could approach on that basis.
Right.
Whereas
right.
some of their competitors didn't. And then also some of the competitors had other types of ABCP. So these some people did better than others about that. But that did occur before some of those pressures were there
yeah.
before Lehman. But that was the,
yeah.
the sort of the grand mal was after Lehman.
Right.
So who in the Fed would you think would have been the one focusing on the repo part of this money markets?
The repo funding
You said you guys were looking
yeah.
at commercial paper. Sounded like pretty close from
yeah.
a market stability point of view. And so who would have
did
picked
the
up?
If you know the answer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course.
Yeah. I don't know a particular person. New York keeps the repo
okay.
data.
So probably because of their relationship with primary dealers, they were. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. A lot of the questions you're asking about was with repo. So, were there any other parts of the money markets that you treated with the kind of the thoroughness that you treated commercial paper? I mean, what about interbank lending through what you might think of the LIBOR market or that kind of unsecured interbank
mm-hmm.
lending?
Mm-hmm. That's not, again, that's a financial, mm-hmm. that's a financing, a market to finance the financial sector.
I see. But so since some of the CP was non-financials, then
that's
that
really
was kind of your
that
entree.
That was our entree.
I see.
Yeah.
You mentioned that, but I didn't quite interpret
yeah.
it that way. Okay.
And then asset-backed, once we understood that there were, in the early part of the decade, that there was financing of non-financial corporations going on as part of that through these multi-seller programs,
yeah.
then we started breaking that out separately. And
right, so it was a kind of a financial CP in a way, but it
yeah.
was for the more immediate benefit of the non-financial sector.
That's
yeah.
right.
So
whereas
that's right.
with the mortgage-backed securities, you don't really think of that as a housing issue, but really a financial mortgage originator issue, unlike the receivables and other other types of multi-seller.
That's right.
One way of looking
at it. Yeah, I think that's right. That's right. That's a good way to do it.
Sorry, I don't write as fast as I hear. Did the Fed begin to focus more on OTC derivative counterparty risk or other elements in the over-the-counter derivatives market after, let's say, either February 07 or maybe the bear hedge fund problem in June 07? Was there any kind of a moment there when monitoring changed?
Yeah. So I can't speak to that.
That was, again, a different part of the... Okay.
Yeah. I don't know who to point to there.
Well, let me ask you a little bit different question.
Yeah.
More, when it started becoming more apparent that there was at least some serious system-wide turmoil, did the Fed change the way it conducted its daily activities? In a sense, did it form a kind of a crisis working group, or was there a sort of an ad hoc arrangement formed to kind of grapple, or were the lines of organization that preexisted the crisis fully adequate to do what needed to be done?
Again, based on what?
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you, David.
So, based on what we know, I'd say we worked within the existing structures. This place is pretty good communication across divisions. You get the economists, you get the supervisors, you get the lawyers, you get the policy. We respond as needed. It was pretty all hands on. Anyone who could contribute was asked to contribute. It was a few long years. there was not a special.
There wasn't sort of an elite huddle of senior supervisors or anything outside the normal organizational.
I think, you know, when you're in crisis management, you ask everyone for help who thinks they can contribute.
So the crisis dictated the inclusiveness.
Yeah. And this organization fosters that, I think.
Did you take on any specialists? Task, projects, assignments on a rapid fire basis that would be interesting to talk about? Initiatives?
Some of the events dictated what we worked on. I mean, I guess that would be crisis management. Some of these things came along pretty quickly. You try to anticipate.
Can you give an example?
I don't know if the stress tests fall in that category. It's quite a bit later. Stress tests. Just trying to how to implement capital, how to get capital into the banking system. There were lots of people pulled together to think about issues and all kinds of alternatives. You should think through lots of them, and everyone's perspective. People were encouraged to put out ideas, and once settled on a program, then you just draw in system resources and the stress test in particular. We had within the first week of it, we had 150 people across the system, across all kinds of disciplines. Contributing to different parts. That's
150 just within the board.
The Federal Reserve System.
Oh.
The system. So because our supervision is delegated to the 12 Reserve Banks, and then there were 19 institutions, you wanted to draw all the resources that knew about those institutions. And then you bring in the financial market specialists and the economists and then the accountants and then the lawyers and then the, you know, and before you know it, you just, you know, you've got a lot of people.
In the case of the stress test, it seems really challenging to organize and keep and maintain the organization of that, especially since probably a lot of those people also do many other things at the same time. So was there a director for that?
Yeah. So early on, they appointed a director. I mean, once we decided this was going to happen, we created an infrastructure, and a director was appointed, a supervisor, and in my view, she could organize anything. She was unbelievable. And then set up a governance structure, you know, with here's this team that reviews this, and, you know, all of a sudden you have eight teams, different credit lines, and then you have a process to review that. You've got this outside. It was pretty remarkable, and we worked on that.
Who is the woman who did it?
Is this public? I assume.
I assume.
I don't know either.
We'll tell you. Okay. I think it's
it. It has to be.
We'll get you the name. But mention the interagency aspect too.
Yeah. So then, part of the process, which was, you know, you create these teams to look at different asset risks. You have some oversight. Then there's regular monitoring. Part of the oversight process involved the OCC and the FDIC. So they were brought in at a high level, and they were also every other day. You know, at a certain time of day, there were phone calls, you know, where everybody just called in and it was an update on progress that day. This went on for like 8 or 10 weeks. We, you know, it would just, and literally the calls were at least every other day. We were at the oversight level. I don't know how many times people who were like doing the work. And it was across the agency. So, for example, you could have a group that focused on credit cards or mortgages, and they had people from the Reserve Banks, the Fed, the board, the FDIC, the OCC, you know, whoever.
About the RTS or the SEC, since you're dealing
with? The SEC doesn't regulate in the supervised banking institutions in that way. I mean, that's not what they're.
But the stress tests were extended to the broker, what were formerly broker dealers, and they just become bank holding companies. And so I must have they didn't have any useful knowledge of those broker dealers that was relevant to the stress tests.
I don't know. So I didn't work on the trading book all that much. I mean, they didn't have no loans, so or at least the loan portfolio was not an issue, and I did not. So I don't know if on the trading book they were closely involved or not. The OTS was involved at times. That's right.
And was the Fed always the lead?
Yes. Well, I think we were designated as the lead.
Treasury was involved.
Yeah, so Treasury was out of the process until we told them at the end what the results were. Treasury was involved only to the extent that if any firm needed capital, they were available, they would make capital available under a program they created. But they were not supervisors, and so they didn't have access to any data or, this was a supervisory effort.
So they were never data gatherers, except in the most anecdotal sort of way.
Yeah, they never.
Treasury Secretary might have been.
Right. Mm-hmm. But the OTS was there. So I don't know all the bank. You know, I'm not a supervisor, so I just, you know, we came at it from the economics point of view, and we had a different eye into the whole thing than those who are, like, on the ground working with the banks, knowing all the institutions and...
No, I mean, I'm an economist, too, and I started out in doing research. But
yeah.
Everyone always says the research department at the Fed is very involved in market surveillance.
Yeah.
And they're not the bank examiners, but they're not academic. They're really watching the markets for, you know, as a surveillance. So that's why we were asking you these questions.
Mm-hmm.
So not that you would necessarily know all the answers, but just to the best of your knowledge, that's why we thought it was still relevant, because you guys didn't do a an academic type of research exercise. You were very involved in these issues, both because of your skill level and just for whatever reason they got tasked to research actual market activity instead of, you know, so.
Yeah. Again, you know, all hands on when things are happening, and it wasn't like it was independent of implications for monetary policy. It's kind of all.
Well, monetary policy is not the only thing the Fed's supposed to be doing, right? So, I mean, they have a broader mandate than that, so that's okay, right? As this, as I understand it, I mean, that's what most of people think of with the Fed, but it doesn't seem to really be all they're doing. Backing up a little bit, when you were talking to people in the market about any possible pressures or turmoil in the commercial paper market, did you run across any instances where there was sort of collateral damage from problems in the ABCP market? In other words, people that were doing fine, they got clobbered because people didn't distinguish, or through any other kind of what you might think of collateral damage.
So we've looked at this from a statistical point of view, mm-hmm. not from talking to people.
Right, ex post.
Ex post. And one thing we noticed pretty early on was that the pricing for the programs that could issue went up sort of uniformly right at the beginning. And then there was more discrimination or tiering after 3 or 4 weeks.
Yeah.
After 3 or 4 weeks. So it looked like in the beginning there was sort of programs were being painted with a broad brush.
How long did it take the market to start discerning these kind of credit quality distinctions?
I think it was, so I don't remember the exact number of weeks, but it was pretty quick.
Yeah.
I remember sort of the bottom line of the quick investigation being something like, yeah, there was this broad the ones who could issue were painted with a broad brush, and then after a few weeks, saw the discrimination in pricing. Now, we've done some longer-term work trying to understand who could issue and who couldn't issue, and that's and whether or not there was sort of broad, unexplainable inability to issue commercial paper, asset-backed commercial paper across program types. And it certainly looks like that may have been the case in August of 2007. But we've also been, when we presented this type of work in academic settings, we've been criticized pretty heavily for it.
What was the criticism?
Because we're inferring something from the residual. We're saying you can't. The broad thing is what you can't explain. The common factor across all program types is the unobservable thing. And so the criticism is, well, you don't really know what's
right.
What investors knew at the time.
Yeah.
And investors
now before
knew
the
more
crime.
Than you know. Mm-hmm. Even though we might know the program type, the maturity structure, the types of support, the health of the institutions providing the support, they would say, well, you don't really know the assets. Someone who's reading the prospectus of the program type would know the assets. Other people say, well, we don't believe that these types of investors are poring over the prospectus trying to figure out what type of assets mm-hmm. are in there. Mm-hmm. So
it's a lot of work for a two-week investment for an extra
two basis points.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well,
but in the academic world, you get two groups of people.
Methodologically, yeah. It's not adequate. From their point of view.
Right, for a residual.
Yes.
To over-interpret a residual is some way to think about it.
People strongly disagree. So some academics really like it and really think mm-hmm. that that's what happened, and some don't believe it.
Now, was there much price discerning before the crisis, or was it a case where it's kind of all AAA or all A1P1s the same? And then
so there was very little. So what we did in our paper.
That's an interesting.
Very, very little.
Narrative.
You know, so asset-backed had like two extra basis points than unsecured, for example.
But within asset-backed, was it all A1P1 all pretty much?
Yeah, so AA, asset-backed, A1P1. There was a few, you know, there were a few, you know, as you know, the CP market is all high-rated, right? So then there's a couple that are like the A2. So they have a little bit of a spread. There was maybe one other feature. I mean, it's just, but the, no, you know, the amount of the basis point difference was generally pretty small. And then those magnified. Once you went into a crisis mode, you know, some of those features just magnified. And for a while, as Dan is pointing out, from our perspective, it just seemed like investors were painting everything with a broad brush. They weren't willing to take anything. But then over a few weeks, things kind of started to settle out. Yeah.
Because essentially they didn't discern before. It was just all priced the same. During the crisis hit, it was all priced the same, but very badly.
Mm-hmm.
And then only over time did they learn to discern, and then they started looking at idiosyncratic properties.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah, I don't know how you pick up learning in a regression.
That's
right. So that's the unmeasurable. So what for a finance guy, you just infer from that? You know, if it's efficient market, then you can infer from this very clearly that they've learned to discern. However, you can't, you know, there was no CFA exam or any other quantitative indication that they learned, right? So the econometricians are frustrated and everyone else feels glad that they finally figured it out. Okay, so that's...
Is it a paper you can share?
There's a working paper version that's out, yeah.
There's a link on both our websites.
Who's the authors?
Dan Kobitz. And Gustavo Suarez.
Okay.
Is this on the website?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
It also has a sort of timeline of all the detailed events that happened in that time.
Right around that window.
Yeah. Now, I didn't want to take too much of your time, but a few more minutes, if you will. The primary dealer's credit facility, is that something you feel comfortable talking about at all?
Not really. I'm not an expert in it.
I wasn't involved in it.
Yeah.
Well, I know that's not the research department runs that thing, but when I meet you guys on an informal basis, you always have opinions. So
<Not today>.
Sorry, I had to say that. Because all my friends from grad school came to the board or to the IMF. So, okay. One thing I had, another sort of organizational question then, do research people other than stress tests otherwise regularly get tasked into surveillance activities? Like, would the surveillance division be able to, you know, like you guys, they got a CP issue pops up at one of their banks, and they go, oh, these guys wrote a paper on CP and research, can we borrow these guys for 6 weeks or something? Is that kind of thing a...
So on TELF, it was an example where we had economists and the people who, you know, run the facilities out of New York, you know, and like more people who might have been involved with Discount Window or some of these other facilities. I mean, we had a lot of economists working on what are the structures of securitization markets, what do you know about automobile loans, student loans, you know, that kind of thing. So in the past, the linkages have been informal. It's not, you know, if, you know, we would hear what the supervisor's views about, say, commercial real estate were. We would have developed our own views. We would have discussions, but it was kind of on an informal basis. Going forward, it's more structured now. We've reoriented the way we supervise the largest institutions. where the economists will have on a regular ongoing basis their perspective into how certain markets, asset classes, the economy more generally, and provide that view so that supervisors are thinking about the same thing, you know, or at least have the ability to engage. We have much more structured and formal discussions than we used to be. It used to be much more informal. And it happened, you know, we briefing the board members on something.
So both the supervisors, examiners have a regular way to access your specialist in certain capital market areas, and then those guys are also, therefore, I guess, also expecting to, they're expected to cooperate when people call up. So it's not like, you're not my boss, it's not my job, what do you want again?
Right.
It's, they're now expected to.
Yeah.
So on the, for the sections that are involved in monetary policy, I think that's exactly right. That say you were briefing the board on the commercial paper market as part of the monetary policy process, something like that, then you would, if you're doing a good job of it, you would also contact people on the supervision side to see what they know about that and to get their perspective and bring them into the room and the run-throughs. And so even before the crisis, there was that type of collaboration informally. There are some sections in research that aren't directly tied to the monetary policy process, and sometimes they help. They seem to be have a closer tie sometimes to helping out. I think the way you put it was something like experts pulling in experts or things like that.
And how long would you say it's really been in this more structured format? Since the crisis, but really,
yeah, well, certainly building off the stress tests. I mean, we just, you know, from the day it was over, it was, you know, okay, we have a new structure and figure out how to do that. So we've been, as the chairman has testified many times, we've implemented, tried to take the lessons learned from the crisis, lessons learned from the stress tests. How do we create, reorient supervision to, you know, sort of use all the skills of the reserve system and bring everything, you know, the markets people, the research people, the payment specialists, you know, there's all kinds of areas to bring. And before that, you know, it was, I would just say it was more informal, but Stan says we're preparing things for the board. You know, it's your job to reach out and make sure that people who know about this are all having their views into it before we take it to the board.
I see. I asked you before about the primary dealer's credit facility.
Yeah.
What about the TSLF? Is that something you feel more comfortable talking about? That was the term securities lending facility?
Yeah, so all of those, all four of those things, you know, so the discount window, and then there's one that extends the discount window, then there's one that goes CAF, and then there's the primary dealers, and then the extension, so we're not the experts.
That's,
I've told you everything I know.
Okay. Well, no, that's right. I didn't. That was something I was asked to ask.
Yes.
And so I wanted to at least be able to tell them
sure.
that.
You know, Randall, something that was covered in an interview in June. Yeah. So you may have, maybe able to go back and pull some of this stuff.
I think, okay. And I think part of it, too, there were. Also interested in your opinion, as well as because I myself thought like, well, this is kind of that, those kind of issues I thought had been beat around enough that it was silly to ask, but I think they were particularly interested
another
in
this
another perspective.
Alexis, that's all I had. Okay. Well, thanks
great.
Very much
sure.
for your time.
Sure. Terrific.
Have a great week.